Before seminary, my work as the director of a large home care agency often sent me to visit one or another of our four offices that were scattered throughout New Mexico. I remember vividly my first trip to our office in northern New Mexico. At that point, we didn't have any clients yet, so we were just beginning to get the word out. Our local manager, Carla, had set up home appointments with about 10 of older adults who she had heard might be in need of our services. To prepare for these meetings, I had worked with one of our employees, a native Spanish speaker born in Mexico, who was also fluent in English, to translate all of our intake documents and brochures into Spanish. I figured this way we could easily accommodate what I understood as New Mexico's bilingual culture. Carla and I met up with our first potential client in a remote area north of Chimayo, in the hills between Taos and Española. Amelia Torres, I remember her so well. She was being cared for by her son, Rowdy, who was, a few years later, to be killed by a drunk driver. But we didn't know that day. On that autumn day, about 15 years ago now, we made our way along the unmarked and crisscrossed dirt roads. Even Carla, who had grown up within 10 miles of the area, got turned around and had to ask for help. We pulled over and asked a woman who was just taking a walk out along the side of the road for directions. She said she knew where we were headed, but she could never explain it, so she just got in the car. Took us there herself. Finally, all three of us pulled up to a house deep in a little hidden valley. We tentatively and quite miraculously made it past three scary, loud, and angry-looking free-roaming dogs to greet a small elderly woman and her son standing on their front porch looking kind of skeptical. We introduced ourselves, and she acknowledged that she somewhat understood why we were there, enough to invite us in, and we sat down to talk. I pulled out my meticulously prepared forms and started to hand them to her. Did she want them in English or Spanish? She looked at us and said something I didn't quite understand. Carla explained, "Mrs. Torres doesn't read or write." "Oh, well, Carla could read her the form that we'd translated to Spanish," I suggested. "That should work." So Carla started in, but it didn't take long before both she and Mrs. Torres looked puzzled, confused, and eventually broke into hysterical laughter. "What?" I asked. "Is something funny? Did I mess something up?" Carla explained, "The form, it's gibberish to us." See, it turns out that native northern New Mexicans speak a whole other language than Mexican Spanish, a kind of mixture of Spanish and English that has become a whole other thing. This document, carefully translating formal English into formal Spanish, was unintelligible to these two women, despite the fact that from their perspective, they had grown up speaking both Spanish and English. Carla stuffed my pretty form in her bag, and then she took out her planner, ripped a couple pages from the back, and launched into asking Mrs. Torres her story. What did Rowdy do for her? How was that going? It was so obvious and easy, I could feel myself blushing. I thought of all the time and care I had put into ensuring we had just the right words printed perfectly on those neat and nice pages. I thought of how long I'd fussed over which questions needed to be asked, the order of the questions, and whether I'd left enough space to write. At one point in their conversation, which despite my semi-fluency in at least one kind of Spanish and 100% fluency in at least one kind of English, I was barely following, I realized they were both giggling to themselves again. They looked up at me and Carla explained. She had brought out my form to make sure she'd asked most of the questions and had come to the one about mouth care. I'd read all about how dental care in the area was often overlooked, so I was sure to put a section on the form to ask about the dentist and if she needed help brushing her teeth, etc., etc. Mrs. Torres then looked at me straight in the eye and smiled big and pointed at her mouth, which was all gums. "No hay dientes," she said. "No dental care needed. She didn't have teeth." A year later, when we opened our office in Las Cruces along the southern border, I finally discovered a culture that more closely approximated what I had imagined finding in northern New Mexico. And still, in Cruces, I also discovered that many of our clients, quite able to use and appreciative of those formal Spanish translated forms, would refuse any of our Mexican caregivers because they didn't care for Mexicans. When they saw my puzzled looks, they'd explain they weren't Mexican, they were Spanish. Their ancestry was from Spain, not Mexico. Journalists and sociologists, I mean, really all of us, we talk about Hispanics as if Hispanic is a singular fixed thing. It's like how we talk about gay people as if gay was a singular fixed thing, or Christian, or conservatives, homeless, or women, or any of these words we try to use to talk about a group that shares a certain kind of knowledge or experience in common. We name things in part, at least in part, because we want to make known and familiar what feels unknown and unfamiliar, to turn strangers into possible friends. It is well intended. We want to be able to say, I know some things about this group I previously didn't understand at all. We want to be able to say, although I am not Hispanic, I want to understand some things about the Hispanic culture, and my discovery instructs me to ensure our form should be in both Spanish and English. And yet, in our attempt to make intelligible the unfamiliar, we can inadvertently obscure the real variety and particularity amongst people, and ironically further deepen the divide between and among us as we attempt to bridge our differences. Historian of religions Jonathan Z. Smith calls this the magic of comparison, whereby simply attempting to compare two things, we inevitably flatten out differences and overemphasize similarities. He said it's like you put two things together and poof, they have similarities. Our human brains see and name connections, commonalities. We make sense of the world and our place in it by way of what we already know. We bridge differences by calling ourselves the same. Claim solidarity by telling ourselves we all exist in a single story. I was on a conference call a while back with a bunch of other Unitarian Universalist ministers, all of us well-versed in the strategies of anti-racism and multiculturalism. It was our first call, and only a few of us had met previously, which is why I was surprised when the first topic of conversation was how we would need to recruit greater diversity into our planning team. It was a conference call, right? Very confusing. I mean, maybe they all knew each other better than I knew them. But even if they'd done a really thorough job of Googling me, they couldn't possibly know me well enough to claim that we were insufficiently diverse. They didn't know my story, my cultural roots, the things that drive me, my perspectives or values. They didn't know my people, my parents or their parents. They didn't know my children. They didn't know my heartbreaks, my struggles, or my passions. All they could know was that I presented as a woman, and I appeared white. Maybe they also knew I was partnered with another white woman presenting person. And I suppose from my own Facebook stalking of them, I knew they all appeared to be white too. And of course, we were all Unitarian Universalist ministers. But I knew nothing else about them or them me, which means we knew next to nothing. The racial construct of white identity, as it has formed over many generations, takes J.Z. Smith's hocus pocus of comparison to an extreme. Over time, more and more groups of people have been added into this group called white. And then all of those people's variety has been erased in service of a uniformity that locates difference outside the boundaries of whiteness, and then privileges whiteness as normal and everything else as different and other. This is how white people can end up lamenting how only non-whites have culture, and how we could look out at a primarily white congregation and imagine there's no diversity here, or across a primarily white town and talk about it as if there is one story here, one culture here, when in reality there is more variety even within a single row in this sanctuary than we could capture or understand in a single lifetime. Indeed, there is more variety, contradiction, complexity, and activity in a single person than we can even begin to comprehend, let alone name. After all, sometimes the greatest and most terrifying stranger is the one we discover within our own self. Now, it may be my professional bias, but my theory is that this insistence on and privileging of homogeneity is a theological issue. The dominant theological construction of God, particularly in the Western monotheistic religions and cultures, locates ultimacy in sameness, uniformity. God is unchanging, consistent, constant. God is common ground. God always remains across all time and space and culture and geography. God is in similarity, sameness, and there is one right belief about God and others are wrong. One right way to worship, right ways to act, and others wrong. With a God such as this, policing difference becomes holy work, and ensuring purity becomes a sacred act. And yet, when I think about the scientific truth of our underlying unity, that we are all literally made of the same stuff, we of stars and stars of us, and our interdependence and interconnectedness, and still somehow this wondrous mystery that all this sameness gets embodied and storied in infinitely different ways. How is it possible that we could start out with so many of the same materials, and yet produce such profound difference? In this paradox lies a new understanding of the holy, a new concept of God. God is not constancy, but evolution. Not flattened out sameness, but a great web of interdependent and yet radical difference. The holy in this view is discovered through pluralism, diversity, particularity, and the relationship between and among all these things. God is difference put in relationship. And difference put in relationship facilitates creativity, collaboration, change, discovery, innovation, vibrancy, love, life. In this theological construction, we might best imagine God as symbolized in the hyphen, that signifier of the joining up of two otherwise individual and disconnected concepts or ideas. God is the linking together of two countries, emotional or literal, the transgressing of boundaries. God is the crossing of borders, the encounter of the stranger in the in-between, and the transformation that results. There were many moments as I was writing this sermon where I thought about scrapping the whole thing and instead reading aloud from one of the recent articles about the children on the border. The stories of children, many of them my children's ages, fleeing from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and other countries south of here, children traveling thousands of miles on their own to escape violence, drugs, and poverty, like most of us cannot even fathom. These stories, if you have ears to hear, will break your heart. If you haven't yet taken the 20 or 30 minutes to fully absorb just one of these gut-wrenching stories, I urge you to make it your bedtime reading tonight. Mother Jones and New York Times both have plenty of material to begin. Maybe it's naive, but I have to believe that if we were able to release ourselves from the rhetoric, from the statistics, the politics, no person would be able to look the other way. No one, after hearing their stories, would be able to look at these kids in the eye and say, "We're sending you back." No one would be able to confuse what we call the rule of law with the moral authority of caring for the most vulnerable among us. No one would be able to forget the moral imperative to forge relationship across difference. No one could refuse the call of love, taken one at a time. I have to believe that any one of us would make up a bed in some corner of our home, offer them food and water and popsicles, watch our children play with them, break up their squabbles, and find them sweetly irritating. If given the chance, I have to imagine we'd struggle and it would be hard and we wouldn't understand them and they wouldn't understand us. And truthfully, even with the best of love and care, we'd come to realize we can't undo their lives up until this point, can't make it all better, can't turn them into us, which is, we remember, not the point anyway. They would make their own paths, wrestle with their own demons, find a way to be okay, even when they aren't, which of course we all do to some extent. And over time, we may come to realize that though they were the literal immigrants, we too have traveled to an unknown country by welcoming them. We too have become border crossers, navigating unknown lands, unintelligible and dangerous. We too have been permanently changed by the journey. I wonder sometimes if this is the real barrier to receiving the fullness of these stories, or the stories of anyone that we think of as different. Opening our hearts, living in the hyphen, is a risky, vulnerable task requiring self-awareness, self-differentiation, humility, and courage. When we reach out to the other, we risk exposing ourselves as other. We risk our claim to that homogeneous and stable center, risk our claim to the stability and privilege, and risk exposing the stranger and the immigrant within. Last week, Kelly spoke to you about companioning or accompanying, walking with, as a principle of spiritually grounded social change. Accompanying one another across our differences rather than in an over-idealized, imagined sameness requires this kind of mutual immigration. And in fact, it requires not only that we take occasional trips beyond our own stories and experiences, but that we take up residence in the borderlands, that we become fluent in La Frontera. Many of us as individuals actively practice this kind of border crossing. This is the motivation behind our ESL tutoring, our faith family hospitality, the interfaith circles that Elizabeth Sink started at CSU this year, and even our parish visitors and our small group ministry, and a number of other programs. Indeed, it is likely one of the motivations that brings you to this diverse community. In each of these ways and many others, as individuals, we reach out beyond ourselves and risk connecting across difference. What I'm wondering about now is what it would mean to be a community who resides in the borderlands. Our Unitarian Universalist Good News calls our community as an institution to risk the comfort of home, to go out into the unknown and risk that encounter with the stranger, to stand in solidarity, speak out in witness and serve a vision of our mutual salvation and liberation. For in these borderlands resides the call of love and the living spirit of God. As individuals and as a religious community, may we have the courage and the clarity of conviction to seek such a path, and in doing so, may we all be free. Amen, and blessed be.